From Indianapolis and 90.1 WFYI News, I'm Jill Dittmeyer with your WFYI Weekly News Roundup. Since the 1970s, the concept of providing the homeless and mentally ill in Indianapolis with substance abuse detox and other services has been a goal for advocates. And this week, it became a reality with the opening of the new Albert and Sarah Rubin Engagement Center. Andrea DeMink is with The Poor House. They're an outreach organization that connects the homeless with services. She says the engagement center fills a gap for people living on the streets.
I just think it's an amazing opportunity for people that have wanted to move forward in their lives and perhaps start the journey of facing their addiction.
It's estimated the center will save Indianapolis between $3 and $8 million a year by keeping people out of emergency rooms and jail. And it's that projected savings that helped City County Councilor Leroy Robinson find bipartisan support for operating expenses.
It's important that we have a stake in homelessness. I think that by us leading this effort in creating this center, which we own and operate and are run by the city, shows our commitment to issues of homelessness in our city.
The 30-bed facility, located on Market Street just east of downtown, will have 20 beds for the homeless and 10 for those diverted from the Arrestee Processing Center. This week, the city also received $5 million from the federal government to help end homelessness. As WFYI's Drew Dodlin reports, most of that money will go toward housing efforts.
The incoming $5 million comes from HUD. That's the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. Alan Witchie, executive director of the Coalition for Homelessness Intervention and Prevention, or CHIP, says the dominant philosophy at HUD states that housing is the crucial first step for a homeless person to become self-sufficient.
If you don't have housing, that basic need, you can't focus on other issues. You can't focus on a job. You can't focus on your addiction. You can't focus on your mental health issue.
The city's request for similar funds was rejected in 2015, a disappointment some agencies blamed on then-Mayor Greg Ballard's administration, which he says this year's successful bid is the result of a closer adherence to HUD's requirements and the leadership of Mayor Hogsett. More than 8,000 people experience homelessness in Indianapolis throughout the year, according to annual reports from CHIP. For 90.1 WFYI News, I'm Drew Dudlin.
Mayor Joe Hogsett is also trying to find a replacement for his chief of police after Troy Riggs resigned at the end of last year. Hogsett interviewed several internal IMPD candidates this week. He says he wants the new police chief to stay on track with the initiatives that are already in place.
The groundwork that was laid by Chief Troy Riggs and the command staff in 2016 was exactly the way that IMPD needs to focus its attention in 2017. And by that I mean not only adding resources to the focus areas and our community-based policing approach, but also the holistic approach to crime generally.
Now, over the weekend, he named 24-year IMPD veteran Valerie Cunningham as acting chief. She is currently the deputy chief of the patrol division and serves as night watch commander. You're listening to the WFYI Weekly News Roundup. I'm Jill Dittmeyer. In a few hours, friends and colleagues of former Indianapolis Mayor Bill Hudnut will gather to pay their respects. Hudnut passed away 2 weeks ago at the age of 84. WFYI's Lee DeNoon looks back at the man who was ordained a minister but found his calling as a mayor.
William H. Hudnut III was born in Cincinnati, grew up in New York State, and became a Presbyterian minister like his father and grandfather before him. It was the ministry that brought him to Indianapolis in 1962. After 9 years in the pulpit at Second Presbyterian Church, he served one term in the U.S. House of Representatives before being voted out. Then he turned his passion for service on Indianapolis.
I went up to see Dick Lugar, and I said, "Are you going to run for mayor again?" He said, "No, I'm not going to." We just worked our tails off in that campaign. I went door to door with a bicycle and so forth. It was retail politics at the time.
Ridiculed as India No Place, home of the Indy 500, Mayor Hudnut focused on positive change. Soon, Indianapolis was known as the amateur sports capital of the world. Union Station and the downtown canal were redeveloped, and prior to a deal for an NFL team, Hudnut convinced the city to build a dome stadium connected to the convention center.
Probably when the history books are written, the highlight of the 16 years I was mayor was the Colts coming to town.
The man who succeeded Hudnut, former prosecutor Steve Goldsmith, says Hudnut was a shining example.
I would not have built a stadium without a football team. Who would do that? The lesson I took from Bill Hudnut and his administration as mayor of Indianapolis was think big.
After a scolding by then Urban League president Sam Jones about the lack of diversity on the Airport Authority Board, Hudnut not only appointed an African-American to that board, but other high-level positions. He also imposed 25% quotas for minorities for every new recruit class for the Indianapolis police and fire departments. That affirmative action decision brought legal action from the U.S. Justice Department in 1985. That suit was dropped the following year.
I want to be remembered as the person who danced the jig with a woman downtown in the city county building when she was awarded one of our housing project. What was that called? It was a federal housing program. We would give dollar houses, and they would promise to put their sweat equity in it for 3 years. And there were so many people that wanted those houses that we had to have raffles. And this lady won a raffle, and she came running down the aisle and threw her arms around me. Oh, thank you, Mayor. Thank you, Mayor. You know, those little things make a difference.
And from an interview at the end of the final term, Hudnut was overcome with emotion because he so dearly loved his time in office.
I've enjoyed being mayor for 16 years, and I'm sorry it's over.
Hudnut battled heart failure and throat cancer. He was preceded in death by his son Michael and daughter Laura. He is survived by his wife, Beverly, and four sons. For 90.1 WFYI News, I'm Lee Dinoon, Indianapolis.
What do you wonder about Indianapolis?
Why did Pogue's Run get buried underground?
Why are there so many potholes?
Who's in charge of synchronizing all the stoplights in town?
With Curious Indy, you can ask questions and help WFYI News decide what we should be reporting on next, and sometimes even be part of finding the answer. So, Curious Indy? Go to wfyi.org/curiousindy to find out more.
You're listening to WFYI's Weekly News Roundup. This week, Governor-elect Eric Holcomb appointed Allen County Auditor Tara Klutz as the state's new chief financial auditor.
Besides being super excited about the opportunity to work at the state, I'm also very knowledgeable about all the work ahead and just the next week, trying to make sure we transition well from here and leave well and make sure the office is going to be in good hands.
Klutz replaces current state auditor Suzanne Crouch, who will serve as Holcomb's lieutenant governor. Abortion remained a contentious issue for the state in 2016 with a new law, demonstrations, and three lawsuits. WFYI's Jill Sheridan looks back on Indiana's abortion debate and forward to the issue's forecast in the 2017 legislative session.
In recent years, lawmakers in a handful of states have passed more restrictive abortion laws. Legal director at the American Civil Liberties Union of Indiana, Ken Falk, says Indiana is part of that trend.
I think the legislative inclination, as indicated by the statutes that keep getting passed, indicates that it wants to be as restrictive as possible, and in fact, more restrictive than current law allows.
The ACLU and Planned Parenthood blocked a number of the recent statutes in court, including measures to defund Planned Parenthood and stricter building standards for certain abortion clinics. And Falk represented Planned Parenthood in its most recent suit against the state last year.
The legislature said that if you are getting an abortion for certain specific reasons, one of them being genetic abnormalities or disabilities, you absolutely cannot get an abortion, period, even when the fetus is not viable.
With genetic disabilities, the law also banned abortions motivated by the race or gender of the fetus. This is former Representative Casey Cox, Republican from Fort Wayne, who sponsored the bill, speaking on the House floor.
It also says, from the state of Indiana's perspective, that we can say that ours is a policy that values your life, no matter who you are, where you come from, or what your disability may be.
The 2016 law also included provisions that would require an unborn fetus to be cremated or buried and have a death certificate. Both new regulations were ruled unconstitutional by district court. The state may still appeal. Pieces of this past year's law still stand. First, a court has yet to rule on a suit over the new law that women view an ultrasound and listen to a heartbeat 18 hours before an abortion. The state already requires the review, just not 18 hours before, and women may sign a form to decline. Indiana Right to Life would not comment for this story, but said in a press release that the 18-hour rule gives women more information about their health and pregnancy. The pro-life organization says it can't comment until a third lawsuit is resolved. The 2016 law also made it illegal to use fetal remains in scientific research. Indiana University is suing the state. The initial hearing for that case is slated for September 2017. A number of the regulations passed since 2011 stand as well, including the law that physicians have hospital admitting privileges and that abortions may only be performed through the first 20 weeks of pregnancy. Planned Parenthood still opposes the trend towards more restrictions, but its Indiana and Kentucky Vice President for Public Policy, Patty Stauffer, says she's hopeful.
I think the one thing, if there was a silver lining to the legislation, the very egregious legislation that we saw passed last session, is that it mobilized a lot of people who had not traditionally been in this fight to now see where things could go when people aren't paying attention.
In this 2017 legislation session, a new House bill would ban all abortions. Hoosiers for Life Executive Director Amy Schleister worked with its author, Representative Kurt Nicely, last year on a bill that would have banned abortions after a heartbeat is detected. She says it didn't go far enough.
You know, why are we messing around with regulating abortion when we can go for the gold? I mean, if it's going to get caught up in court, if it's going to create this whole facade that they're seeing, I mean, it's already doing that with their incremental.
But the forecast for the new bill is poor. Lawmakers like Republican House Speaker Brian Bosma have indicated they are not in a hurry to get into another lawsuit.
I don't think we're in the business of getting way ahead of the curve so that we can be a test case that's going to cost the state money.
Even given this forecast, it is possible we won't know until late February if the new bill banning all abortions will get a hearing. It could also be included in another bill. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jill Sheridan.
And the state's A through F school grade system is intended to rate a school based on students' test scores and academic growth. But some say that formula just doesn't capture the whole picture of what makes a great school. WFYI's Eric Weddle talked with parents Edward Curtis and Regan Zewald about the op-ed that Curtis wrote defending their children's Washington Township School in Indianapolis. To their dismay, the school was rated a D.
The school that both your children attend was rated an A the past 2 years. So what was your first thoughts when you saw that grade come out based on what you knew about the school
right.
already?
So our son's been at an F school, a C school, an A school, and a D school, and he's never changed schools. So it's very frustrating. And we, at a certain point, we can laugh this off and say, well, we know that it's different. But we also know that parents are using these to guide their decisions. It's not a helpful system. The students haven't changed that much. The schools haven't changed that much. The grading system is broken.
My first thought was, when an academic gets mad,
he sits down to write.
Yeah. My first thought was not a thought. It was my first reaction was a feeling. I was angry because that's now the label, the big banner that was put on this place that I care about, that is serving hundreds of students, that we have put hours and hours of volunteer work into. And so it just made me plain mad. And so oftentimes when I get mad, I write. And so that's when I decided I would write an op-ed and talk and really sing the praises of the school that is serving not only our kids so well, is serving hundreds of children so well.
And so what are some of the aspects of the school that you like so much that you don't think is recognized in this letter grade?
Right, the things you can't measure. When I talk with other families at our school, the things we like about the school are not necessarily the academic work. We have our kids at this place where they are actively practicing kindness. They are learning conflict resolution, and they are working and playing alongside kids very different from themselves. And is it always perfect? No. It's a human endeavor. These are developing children. But I think this is what we need to be doing more of.
Any day you can go into the school and you hear not only English but also Spanish and Arabic and other languages. I love that.
The governor-elect, Eric Holcomb, he kind of favors still a single A to F grade. And the superintendent-elect, Jennifer McCormick, says she's more open to kind of like a report card maybe style where there'd be multiple grades and different levels. Do you guys have a sense of what you would like to see? I mean, do you think the idea should be scrapped? I mean, it's been controversial since it came in 2011.
I think what helps parents is talking with other parents and other families. The numbers don't mean much. A broader evaluative system would be fantastic. I think we can now agree that the simple A to F is not helpful. It's close to meaningless. It's, as a friend of mine says, it's really the poverty grades. We can pretty easily measure schools and buildings rankings based on the degree of kids experiencing poverty.
Whether you're on the right or on your left, something that everybody can agree on is that parents are responsible for their children's education. And that means that you don't get to outsource your parental responsibility to a state agency giving an A through F grade and then decide on that basis, you know, where you're going to send your kid to school. It means that you have to take the time to investigate your neighborhood school, to investigate the schools, to spend some time inside the building and to talk with other parents in order to find out whether or not that is going to be a good place for your kid. There's no substitute for community and parental involvement here.
Well, yeah. Guys, thank you very much.
Hey, thank you, Eric.
You're listening to WFYI's Weekly News Roundup. Medical and law history in Indiana will be documented and preserved thanks to grants from the Indiana Historical Society. This week, the U.S. District Court for the Southern District of Indiana received $25,000 for its documentary film called Federal Justice in Indiana. Court historian Doria Lynch says the project will feature reenactments of several significant cases in Indiana history.
We're focusing on our case called Ex parte Milligan, which was heard during the Civil War and actually went all the way up to the United States Supreme Court and dealt with issues relating to whether a civilian can be tried by a military tribunal during a time of war.
The film will then be distributed to public broadcasting stations and Indiana schools. The Indiana Medical History Museum is also getting a $50,000 grant, which Rachel Hill Ponko from the Indiana Historical Society says will help its aging building.
It's 120 years old this year, and it has a lot of structural issues. But the next big major thing on our list of stuff to do to preserve the building is replacing all three of the building's skylights. They're single-pane glass. They have cracks in them. They allow condensation. They don't filter the UV light. So there are a lot of issues with them that put the building and the collections at risk.
The grants are funded by the Lilly Endowment. Indiana's bicentennial year ended with a splat last weekend in Vincennes. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Steve Berger was there.
Following a year of celebration, it took just 1.7 seconds to end Indiana's bicentennial Saturday night. Organizers chose to complete the official observance of Indiana's bicentennial with the annual watermelon drop on New Year's Eve in Vincennes.
So what does it sound like when the melons hit the platform?
Like a smack, kind of.
Like boom shakalaka laka boom.
It's kind of a splat.
Something like that.
During Indiana's bicentennial year, there were magnificent art displays, stirring speeches, and beautiful musical performances. But it still ended with a splat on the banks of the Wabash River in Vincennes. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Steve Berger.
And I suppose that's better than a falling bison. Indiana lawmakers went back to work this week, too. They'll spend the next 4 months creating a 2-year state budget and crafting a plan and most likely a tax increase to help fund road and infrastructure improvements in the state. You can learn more about what's in store for the 2017 legislative session that's coming up next on The Lawmakers. For 90.1 WFYI News, I'm Jill Dittmeyer.